message did the American people send out with their overwhelming choice to support Trump's Republicans on November 5th? How is financial and foreign policy likely to change, if at all, under the 47th president? Will Trump's victory signal the beginning of the end of NATO as we know it? Will figures like Larry Fink, Peter Thiel, and Elon Musk benefit financially regardless of who grabs the brass ring in these quadrennial puppet shows of power? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we will be reviewing the impact of the 2024 selection of the U.S. Commander-in-Chief and assess whether or not it will really make a difference for America and the world going forward, and for whom. We will have discussions with economic and financial writer and commentator Dr. Jack Rasmus, writer Dmitry Orlov, and host of the Corbett Report, James Corbett. On this week's program, Election 2024, Governments Change, the Agenda Stays the Same. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 8th, 2024. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.com. We acknowledge that this was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Ojibwe, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The settlers and Indigenous people need to overcome the injustices of the past by addressing the crimes, arriving at reconciliation and paying reparations, which can include land back and solidarity struggles, and ultimately striving to renew a respectful partnership over the land and resources of this territory. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. These, in the end, did not veer much beyond attacking Trump as a threat to democracy, women's rights, and reproductive freedoms. They tended to remain unclear on the issue of economics. From foreign to domestic policy, Harris failed to distinguish herself as one able to depart from the Biden program in her own right. Instead, it was hoped that some organic coalition of anti-Trump Republicans, independents, black voters, women, and American youth would somehow materialize at the ballot box. In a September 16th meeting with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, longtime allies of the Democratic Party, Harris failed to convince its leaders that she would protect the livelihood and jobs of workers better than Trump. That comes from the article, The Price of Eggs, Why Harris Lost to Trump, by Dr. Binoy Kampmark, posted November 7th. The Republicans also win control of the Senate for the next 2 years. Control of the House is still on knife's edge as of this moment, though it looks like the Republicans will also have a majority. This would give the new president substantial power to implement his campaign promises, like ending the wars in Ukraine and the Middle East, as Mr. Trump assured several times during his campaign. This would mean a monumental shift in U.S. policy vis-a-vis Russia and Israel. Will the new president be able to pull that through despite the strong Zionist and war lobbies? This uncertainty may be the reason why Russian President Vladimir Putin did not congratulate President-elect Trump and has no intention to do so, according to the Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov. That comes from the article, President Trump reelected. What's next? Is the deep state divided? Has Putin congratulated President-elect Trump? By Peter Koenig, posted November 7th. The reason U.S. presidential elections are so close and U.S. politics remain divided pretty much 50-50 is because both parties are constantly walking the tightrope of trying to give the donor class as much as possible while giving Americans as little as possible and still getting votes. As soon as they figure out they can make fewer concessions to ordinary voters and still have a chance at winning, they roll back those concessions to make concessions to the plutocrats who own them. They're constantly calculating how little they can get away with giving the voting public. Give too much to the people and the plutocrats switch sides. Give too little and the people won't vote for you. So they both walk it right up to the line year after year, keeping them split right down the middle and never changing the status quo in any major way. That comes from the article, "Oh No, Now the U.S. Will Have a President Who Does Bad Things," by Caitlin Johnstone, posted November 7th, originally published on Caitlin's newsletter. Here's a film about the 1950s, the world as it was, that will tell you a great deal about life in the USA today, while disabusing anyone of the notion that nostalgia for that mephitic decade is in order. For it was a time when quote-unquote democracy tended toward totalitarianism. In doing so, it sowed the bitter fruit that is poisoning us today. Without understanding the long-standing effects of those years, it is impossible to grasp the deepest dimensions of our current nightmare. Chapter 1 of the documentary series Four Died Trying, directed by John Kirby and produced by Libby Handros, appropriately subtitled, quote, "To See Where We Are, Look Where We've Been," unquote, does that brilliantly. That comes from the article, quote, "The World as It Was," unquote, a masterly documentary film, quote, "Four Died Trying," unquote, JFK, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr., RFK, by Edward Curtin, posted November 7th, originally published on the author's website, Behind the Curtain. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Getting our look at the recent U.S. elections, I'm joined by Dr. Jack Rasmus. He holds a Ph.D. in political economy. He's written several fictional and non-fictional books, including The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Economic Policies from Reagan to Trump, and of the upcoming book, The Decline of U.S. Imperialism. And he blogs at jackrasmus.com. I asked him to explain, first of all, what exactly Americans said with their vote this past Tuesday.
Yeah, well, I think the message is, as I've been saying in my writing and my radio show for weeks and months now, that the economy is the number one issue, particularly, inflation as well as other economic issues. And, you know, the Democrats kept pushing, these identity politics and focusing on suburban women and the reproductive rights and other woke and identity issues. But that's not what people voted on here. Very clearly, they voted, the problems with inflation and other economic. They voted their pocketbook, and you can see that even in the swing of minority voters, black voters and Hispanic voters, young voters, they all shifted and turned out for Trump. And a significant thing about the election is the voting Democrat typical voters just didn't go to the polls. 81 million voted for Biden in 2020, but it looks like there's about 67 million only voted for Harris. So we have a big number sitting home, not coming, to vote, which really is a criticism of the whole program of the Democrat Party here, which is really Biden's policy. You see, the number one thing, the takeaway, or one of the number one things, is that Harris did not reject the Biden policies, whether it was the war policies or the domestic policies. When she was asked, I think in one of the public interviews, what would you do different? She says nothing. Well, that was the beginning of the end. She did not differentiate herself from Biden. She was a Biden clone here, according to the Democrat Party. And that's number one reason why she lost, I think. You know, inflation in the U.S. is 30-35% in the last 4 years, really taking a whack out of disposable incomes of just about all the families. And what was their solution for that? There was no solution. You know, it was accepted, or they argued, well, inflation's coming down. Well, you know, it's not come down from the level that it was. And wages, real wages, that simply did not grow. I've documented this all in analysis on my radio show and in articles and on my blog, jackrasmus.com, if anyone wants to see the facts about the economic issues here. So, you know, she didn't speak to the issues. She was running with past issues, a big strategic error by the Democrat Party leadership. They thought they could just plug somebody in there with a friendly face and keep running the Biden policies, but that proved to be a disaster. I had predicted that the election electorally would be 302 for Trump and 236 for Harris. As it turns out, it looks like 312 electoral votes, pretty close for Trump and 226 for Harris, which is exactly almost the vote that occurred in 2020, except flipped. And it's almost exactly the same as the vote in 2016. You see, these seven swing states, which were the key, just flipped in 2020 and flipped back. They flipped in 2020 because there was a unique set of circumstances and conditions, you know, COVID and the recession, the shutdown and everything. And Biden didn't have to go out there and actually campaign. He sat in his house there in Delaware and he campaigned, you know, media-wise. But that all changed here. We were back to a 2016 conditions and scenarios. And so we got a 2016 vote. So all this talk about, Trump was an aberration in 2016, it turned out to be, no, Biden was an aberration in 2020. And what we see is this long-term trend returning, which is really related to the 2008-10 crash and the conditions that followed that for working class and most middle class folks here. They simply did not recover from it. And that's continuing and actually exacerbated, with the 2020 COVID recession. So it's really a continuation of the crisis in the U.S. economy and the crisis of neoliberal policies, which really hit a wall in 2008-10. And that's what we're seeing here long term. 2020 was an aberration from that whole trend because of those specific, unique, one-time set of conditions which do not exist again. We're back to the long-term trend here, and it's a long-term trend of decline for living standards for working class and middle class folks. And that's how they voted here once again in 2024. By the way, I also predicted the Senate would go Republican 52-48, and it looks like 52-47. And the House of Representatives right now, we got seven key constituencies out in California that haven't been determined yet, but they're all leaning Republican. So it looks like Republicans will keep the House as well. So it's a clean sweep, pretty much, for the Republicans. And you can attribute that to Biden policies and dumb strategies on the part of the Democrats, once again, fighting the last war, not the new one, and a weak candidate. And that's really what we're looking at.
It seems as if there's a historical the closest historical analogy of this this election is the election where Lyndon Johnson stepped down and then Hubert Humphrey ran also as a vice president and lost during the unpopular Vietnam War and a rise in inflation. You'd think that, you know, that this with this historical analogy in mind, that's the first thing that place they'd look if they're going to, you know, get rid of Biden and put his vice president in his place. I mean, do you think the party heads really thought that Trump was so different a candidate from Nixon that the analogy simply wasn't accurate, or were they just in complete and absolute denial about Biden's cognitive ability until the debate performance in July? What do you think of that?
Yeah, well, I called that. I've been writing about that for several days, weeks. I call it the Hubert Humphrey effect. You know, Hubert Humphrey was the VP for Johnson during the 60s and the Vietnam War. And he became the candidate in 68, as you pointed out. And he did not, differentiate himself from the very unpopular policies of the Vietnam War or the inflation of the 60s. And he lost to Nixon. Well, we can now call that the Humphrey-Harris effect, because that's essentially what Harris did as well. As far as the Democratic leadership, they apparently thought that if they could change the face of an old horse, that couldn't win a race anymore, that people would bet on the old horse with a nice face. Well, it's still the old horse, and he still couldn't run, right? And that's exactly what we have here with this election. Democratic Party leaders have been making all kind of strategic errors here. I mean, look at it. Since 2016, they've been manipulating their primaries. There hasn't been an open primary, really, Democratic Party for since 2012. And not even then, because, you had, I would say, 2008, there hasn't been an open primary. And they've gotten a kind of arrogant and lazy, and they think they can just manipulate these primaries, which they've been doing now for a decade, and it's backfired on them. You know, they manipulated Biden in, then they manipulated him out. And then, stupidly, they should have had an open convention and had some competition, but they didn't want to risk losing the Biden policies with somebody new coming in and taking over, like RFK Jr. or somebody. They didn't want to risk that. So they wanted to keep these old policies of war and economic policies going, and it backfired on them, obviously.
Mm. You mentioned that that the economy was really the number one issue for voters in this election, and Trump has is going to change that for the better. And I was wondering if you could assess how his changes to the financial policy, insofar as they are significantly different from the Harris, what impact that's going to have on the nation.
Well, I don't think he can do anything about the inflation, and he isn't going to do anything about inflation. I think we've got a recession in the good sector of the economy that's going to spill over to the rest of the economy next year, and that's going to bring inflation down some. In the meantime, though, it looks pretty clear, recent data, that inflation is not abating any further. We're stuck at a certain level, and that will go up in the short term, but then go down when the recession hits in the spring more severely. The inflation, they're saying it's 2.5%, 2.9%, depending on the price index. I've been saying all along that that's inaccurate and a lowballing of the actual inflation for a whole number of technical reasons, methodologies that I've been describing. Really, we're in a 4 to 5% inflation level, particularly in the services sector. That's not coming down any further. So on top of that, we're going to have a surge of inflation, I think. But then come the spring, the big problem facing either candidate, as I've talked and written about, is this massive fiscal crisis that is brewing. And neither of them talked about this. What is that crisis? Well, it's the deficits and the debt and the interest payments on the debt. The deficits, budget deficit last year was $1.8 trillion, and the national debt's up to $36 trillion. And most importantly, what we're doing is paying bondholders $1 trillion now in interest on that $36 trillion. The Congressional Budget Office forecasted that that national debt's going to $56 trillion over the next decade, and we're going to be paying interest on it to bondholders, both foreign and domestic, of $1.7 trillion a year. That's even more than the Pentagon's getting. The bondholders and the Pentagon are sucking up all the growth and all the income of this country. So what it means is that what we're going to see in the spring is a massive austerity program. whomever was going to win was going to do this, and that includes Trump now. Massive austerity. What that means is that big cuts to social spending coming. That will exacerbate the recession as well. But the big cuts are coming in social programs because Trump is not going to cut defense and war spending. And he's adding to the tax cuts for the rich and the corporations. You know, he cut taxes $4.5 trillion back in 2018. Those are up for renewal now in 25. He's going to extend those and add to them. So he's going to exacerbate the deficit. And if the economy slows down, that exacerbates tax revenues and the deficit even more. Projections are we're going to have we're running at a $500 billion deficit every 3 months. So next year we got a $2 trillion deficit, $38 trillion in the national debt, and interest rates going up over bondholder, you know, interest payments going up over $1 trillion. This is unsustainable. And they know it, and they're going to viciously attack social programs, austerity. That's coming, because one of the first things he's going to do when he gets in office there in 2020 is to push these tax cuts. That's one of his pet projects, along with the immigration bill and building the wall. He's going to push that. He's going to push deregulations, which means that's the end of any climate change and you know, he's going to push drilling and tariffs on China in particular. Those four things: immigration, tax cuts, deregulation, climate, and tariffs. That's coming quickly. After that, the other issues, you know, we'll see how they shake out. But this is going to be the legislative and administrative priorities here in his first 6 months. And that's only going to exacerbate the problem domestically and economically. He has no solutions to it.
Mm. What about foreign policy? I mean, I know he's not going to war as much as he'd hoped to, or he had been positioning himself into now. I mean, how different really will the foreign policy of the United States be, you know, compared to where it was under Biden?
Okay, that's an interesting question. I think he's going to try to find a way to get out of the Ukraine war. The U.S. is already slowly exiting from that financially, but he'll try to find a way. Whether he can have that much influence remains to be seen, because Russia is just going to continue militarily. It's not going to trust anything from any president anymore, any word from any president. So I don't know how he's going to get the Russians to slow down. And as far as Zelensky and the Ukrainians are concerned, I think these neo-fascists are going to do what fascists always do, and that is to go down with the ship. They don't want to negotiate. They'd rather collapse. And so he's going to have a hard time. I think he's going to want to somehow exit Ukraine. But have a harder time than he thinks. As far as the Middle East is concerned, he's a blank check for Netanyahu just as much as Biden and Democrats were. And I think that's the biggest risk, particularly the U.S. getting sucked into a war with Iran. That's the most difficult issue. I don't think he's going to pull out of that. And then, of course, he's going to double down on his economic war on China with the tariffs. He's already started that. Well, the ruling class has already started raising tariffs and embargoes on China and tech and so forth. So we can see that intensifying. So, as far as Europe, he's not that friendly with Europe, and the Europeans must really be worried here today, rightfully so, because the U.S. has already been hollowing out their economy with various measures, sanctions and tax cuts and so forth. So the Europeans are in deep doo-doo, I think, and they know it. That's my survey, except for the question of the BRICS. You know, I've been saying the BRICS is the big existential challenge to the U.S. empire and the dollar right now. That's more of a long-term trend. And I don't see that the U.S. capitalists have any policy on how to deal with the BRICS yet. They're going to have to quickly develop it. They are quietly in the background trying to break off some of the BRIC members to go slow on okaying new members to the BRICS. I mean, they're having some success here with Saudi Arabia and MBS and with Lula in Brazil. But other than backroom kind of influencing, I don't think the U.S. has any policy for the BRICS. But they better develop one soon, or the empire, the dollar is going to decline faster than they think. So that's my view of the Trump foreign policy.
Okay, just briefly, my final question is having to do with the shift in the positions of both parties. I mean, the Democratic Party of Kamala Harris is now embracing Dick Cheney's support, and the Republican Party of Trump is more of the MAGA party or whatever. So that basically the two parties are different from what they were, say, 20 years ago. How is that going to, moving forward? Are we, how is that new division, that new assessment going to change the way we dialogue with each other and the way we, format our policy?
Yeah, I think there's a slow roll party realignment going on here. Very clearly, the neocon and big business, Romneys and Cheneys and everything in the Republican Party are moving over to the Democrats. The Democrats are the party of big, big money now and the neocons very clearly. Harris spent $1 billion in the election here in 3 months. Over the summer, and I don't know how much in October. So they're a party of big money now, and they have elements of the Republicans that have joined them, leaving, the Trump, what was left of the small business, pretty bourgeois, whatever, party called the Republicans. But the Trump party, Republican Party, is moving out, trying to bring in, and has to some extent, absorbed some working class votes, both in the minorities and in the white working class. So you're going to see more of that probably. I wouldn't overemphasize that yet, but very clearly, and you saw that in some of his proposals, his tax cuts, no taxes on tips, no taxes on overtime pay, ending the Reagan tax on Social Security benefits for retirees, $5,000 child care credit, and so forth. These are all appeals to the working class. Whether he does that remains to be seen, but very clearly there's a kind of new coalition in formation here, perhaps, on the Republican side, and that includes some working class elements. And, of course, on the Democrat side, you have more capitalist elements. And that's why, pretty much the Democrats didn't want to go there on working class issues, like they didn't. They're supposed to be the champions of Social Security. They didn't propose, as Trump did, to eliminate taxes on Social Security benefits, which Reagan introduced in the 80s, by the way. And they didn't talk about removing taxes on overtime pay. Their big money donors are very uncomfortable with working class issues and working class appeals. And you could see it in their whole strategy this time around, go after suburban women and reproductive rights and identity issues, woke bullshit, all that, which has failed. We're at the end of identity politics as the key driver in elections, I think, here. And we're shifting now to more truly traditional economic issues, and then as well as wars. There's probably an opening here for third parties after the next 4 years, I think.
Jack Rasmus, we appreciate your thoughts, and we look forward to sharing them on our program. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, anytime.
Jack Rasmus is a writer, also a retired teacher of economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California, and he is also the producer and host of Alternative Visions on the Progressive Radio Network. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
As the dust settles on the election of Trump, which seems to have been settled a lot sooner than other historic elections, we take a look at what it means both for America itself and for the broader community. Dmitry Orlov joins us again after a lengthy absence. Born in Russia, he emigrated to the United States in the mid-1970s. He earned degrees in computer engineering and linguistics, and has worked in the fields of high-energy physics, internet commerce, advertising, and network security. He's written books, including Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Experience, and American Prospects, along with several articles. He's moved back to Russia, and we're interested in his unique perspectives on the politics and geopolitics of his former homeland. Dmitry, welcome back to the Global Research NewsHour.
Good to be with you, Michael.
There's a line by Larry Fink, the head of BlackRock, the world's largest investment country, that says it doesn't really matter who wins the election because both Trump and Harris will be good for Wall Street. Now, Trump's style is obviously different from Kamala Harris, but realistically, is there anything Trump will do that is different from the standpoint of the American general public, either for the better or for the worse?
Well, you have to understand that the United States is not really a country. It's more of a country club, and it's owned by maybe 100 very rich families. So the mock democracy that they stage every 4 years is really to distract the masses. They agree on two candidates, and it doesn't matter to them which one wins. Mr. BlackRock is just pointing out the obvious. It doesn't matter to him which candidate wins because they're both beholden to BlackRock. That's basically what he means. In terms of what U.S. presidents are or are not able to do, it's said that their first day in office, they're shown a film, an educational film, on what they have to do and what they shouldn't do if they want to avoid getting shot, as quite a few U.S. presidents have been over the years. And they generally follow that advice. So I'm sure that that Donald Trump will do what he has to avoid getting shot.
Mm. Well, how will Trump's victory, what does it mean for the future of the war with Russia and the future of NATO itself?
Well, first of all, people say that it's a victory, but I won't believe it until I see the concession speech by Kamala Harris. They have to go through the routine of declaring that they lost, and then they all get to hug each other and cry. Once they do that, then I'll believe that the election has been resolved. Hasn't been resolved yet. In terms of the war with Russia, what war with Russia? Russia has already won the military, the arms race with the United States, along with just a few other countries, China, North Korea, and Iran. It possesses missile technology that obsoletes everything that the West has. So there won't be an armed conflict between the West and these other countries, except for a little proxy conflict here and there. There's one going on in the Ukraine right now. But the United States has been very, very careful to spell it out that they will not be fighting a war directly with Russia. And so there isn't really any reason to speak of that. In terms of what Trump might or might not do, everything he's said so far makes absolutely no sense. For instance, his quote unquote peace plan as far as the Ukraine is concerned is just absolutely ridiculous. What he said is that he will put pressure on the Ukraine and Russia to negotiate by telling the Ukrainians that he will deprive them of all support and weapons if they don't negotiate, and he will put pressure on the Russians by telling the Russians that he will give the Ukrainians all the weapons and support they want if the Russians don't negotiate. So that sort of illogic is just absolutely ridiculous. But that's what you expect from a showman like Trump. I don't expect any great positive developments.
Well, what about the nature of NATO? Because I mean, he was saying that he was going to, you know, well, it worries a lot of the NATO partners because he's actually threatening to with unless they bump up their spending on the defense up to the 2% of their GDP, that they're going to they can't promise that the United States is going to back them. I mean, is this going to signal the end of NATO, or?
Well, I don't know that it'll signal the end of NATO. It's a political entity that can persist in this zombie state for a really long time. But the point is that NATO is incapable of fighting a modern war. Its weapons, its armor, and specifically, which is on display now in both Moscow and St. Petersburg, which has been destroyed and hauled from the battlefield and put on display in Russia, is remarkable in that it's all junk. It's very useful for putting the fear into various tribal nations armed with Kalashnikovs and maybe some RPGs and some improvised explosive devices. But it's absolutely useless against a modern military, be it the Russian or the Chinese or the North Korean. It's just useless against a peer adversary, which is what it faced in the Ukraine. And that explains why a very small Russian contingent has been able to displace and conquer territory held by a very large Ukrainian army that was dug in and equipped with all the up-to-date European armor and European weaponry. It all turned out to be completely useless. So it doesn't really matter what NATO does or says. It's very clear that they won't be able to fight in any modern conflict.
Well, Netanyahu, he did not conceal his preference for Trump. Does that mean that the Israeli war on the Middle East will expand, even including a war with Iran with no restraints, whereas with Kamala Harris and Joe Biden, they were supporting the, you know, genocidal actions towards Gaza, but they were not, you know, there were some, the people within their constituency were saying, no, don't. You know, no genocide on Gaza. So what do you think about that?
Well, I don't think that the U.S. policy towards Israel depends on who is president, because Israel owns half of the U.S. Congress and has inroads into the deep state, into the special services, into the defense establishment. So the Zionists call the shots to a great extent within the U.S., and they, no matter who's president, they can avail themselves of the resources of the United States. The problem with Israel right now is that it can't fight either. The Israeli military has degraded to a point where they haven't been able to repeat their incursion of Lebanon more than one kilometer in without getting destroyed. A lot of that has to do with advancements in modern weapons, which their adversaries now have. But a lot of it really has to do with just a general degradation of Israeli society and Israeli military to a point where now they cannot fight. Something that should have taken 2 weeks in Gaza is taking more than a year and is showing no signs of the mission being accomplished. And in Lebanon, all they seem to be able to do is knock down lots of buildings full of civilians. And that is not a military strategy. That is not really something that can lead to anything anyone could call a victory. So what the Israelis are doing is bleeding the United States dry of weapons and support in order to achieve absolutely nothing. In terms of a war against Iran, the United States is not going to fight a war against Iran. That has already been decided. No matter what kind of belligerent rhetoric comes out of Washington, that is just not going to happen, because the next thing that happens is that Iran turns off the spigot of Middle Eastern oil from the Gulf, and Western economies fall apart completely, while non-Western economies continue to function. And that is not something that the U.S. can survive.
Given the way the U.S. presidency, it continues to, deconstruct, it's each election seems to be stranger than the last. And I'm reminded of your writings on the collapse of the Soviet Union, and you mentioned also the collapse of the U.S. If you had to revise your vision of the form of your vision of the collapse of the U.S., what difference do you think you'd make today from the way you saw it 15 years ago?
Well, there's this graceful degradation, you might say, of the U.S. sham democracy. More and more techniques are being used to achieve the effect of convincing people that they're actually participating in some kind of a democratic decision, whereas they're not. And so there's new technology and new weapons of mass manipulation, and these are all very successful, and to some extent they're even being exported around the world. For instance, in the recent election in Moldova, showed some of the signs of political technology that has been in use in the United States, that has been pioneered in the United States. So in terms of faking it, that is faking being a democratic nation, the United States has a bright future, which is not something that could be said about it in other ways, specifically financially and economically.
That was Dmitry Orlov, a writer and blogger based in St. Petersburg. Stay tuned next week for part two of our interview. Next up is James Corbett.
He's, of course, a film director and a producer based in Okayama, Japan. He started the Corbett Report website in 2007 as an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. He's also an award-winning journalist. He's also a Canadian anarchist, but was agreeable to discussing this issue, election issue, anyway. So thank you so much for joining us, James.
Thank you, Michael. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Okay. Well, in trying to determine the policies of an administration, it makes less sense to listen to the mumbo jumbo uttered during the campaign and more sense to look at the donors of money getting him elected, I think. And then most of the same big money players are also sponsoring the Democrat side as well. So in the end, these parties are for the moneyed class more than for the working class and regular people like that. So with this in mind, how should we interpret what Trump is going to do for the next 4 years or so?
Well, a very good question. And the first thing we should do is correct the question, because Trump is not going to do anything. The person sitting in the Oval Office is a puppet, a cutout, a front man for the deep state military industrial information complex that really runs things with their corporate and financial oligarchs behind the scenes, exactly as you pointed out. That is what has just taken place, is a fight between certain management arms of United States of America, Inc. And who cares who is going to be the CEO of this slavery incorporated? Not me, and hopefully not many people out there who understand what is really happening. For those who don't understand what is really happening, you point, for example, to the reality of the donors are the ones who are really calling the shots and who are presumably running whatever administration gets into power. So on the Harris side, you had, for example, Bill Gates and Eric Schmidt and examples of the Silicon Valley mafia. On that side, on the Trump side, you had Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and examples of the Silicon Valley mafia on that side. Yay, what an amazing difference. Well, not really, except for the fact that it does portend potentially a difference in the composition of that military industrial complex, which is obviously calling a lot of the shots behind the scenes, insofar as Peter Thiel is connected not only to Palantir and Clearview AI and other companies like that, but is also through the Founders Fund, a sponsor of Anduril, which, for example, is one of these companies competing for DOD, DOJ contracts to start the development of the digital ID biometric face scanning border security, which will be the wall. Of course, Americans voted for the wall, right? No, it's going to be a digital wall involving biometric face scanning and digital ID, and people will be happy because they feel like they voted for it, and it will be run by Peter Thiel-connected companies, et cetera, et cetera. The DOD is going to be, of course, contracting with Musk's Starlink and Peter Thiel's Palantir. It's going to be the essentially just different faces on the same evil oligarchy behind the scenes. So this means nothing in terms of the overall agenda. And we can see that again through the donor class. Sheldon Adelson was, of course, a huge donor to Trump 2016. He passed away. So his widow, Miriam Adelson, became a major backer of Trump, with Trump, of course, appearing on multiple stage events with the Israeli flag behind him, because you better believe the Zionist war of aggression in Palestine and the genocide that is going on there will not only not end, it will probably increase in the coming months with Trump's backing. So for anyone who thought they were voting for hope and change, you are as deluded as the people who voted for hope and change back in 2008.
Well, let's bring up the lesser evil argument. You'll note that Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who's the most popular third party candidate, ended up leaving and then supporting Trump, as a player, is the lesser evil, as it were. And a lot of people, during the whole COVID affair, a lot of people, he was correcting a lot of the language about COVID and the pandemic and so on. So a lot of people are saying, well, I don't like either of them, but maybe RFK is going to have a position of being able to give some direction to it and the CDC and all of that stuff. So that might be the signal they need to, I guess, hold their nose and vote for freedom from vaccine mandates and from the pandemic treaty and other initiatives. They've got one of our boys on side. So how would you correct that kind of thinking?
I stand to be corrected. I am going to go out on a limb and make the bold prediction that RFK Jr. will be sidelined as soon as it is convenient to do so within the Trump administration, that he will not gutter the FDA and take over the biomedical industry that is now a multi-billion, heading towards multi-trillion dollar industry in the US. He's not going to dismantle big pharma. He's not going to end the mRNA vaccines. I stand to be corrected on all of that. I think that RFK Jr. genuinely does believe in those issues. I just don't think that Trump is going to give him a seat at the table, because he has other important backers who will not allow that to happen. But I stand to be corrected. And if that happens, I will be the first to line up and give credit where it's due and say, hey, good, this is a great thing that has happened. I'm just not holding my breath waiting for it. And oh, by the way, exactly as we were talking about before, when RFK Jr. was on the campaign trail as a presidential candidate, he had multiple opportunities to back away from, denounce, otherwise decry the genocide going on in Palestine. He not only did not denounce that, he went full-throated in his defense of Israel, the state of Israel. He was 100% for the genocide taking place there. So once again, we will see not an ounce of difference between Biden and Trump on that front.
I imagine even if Trump did have that inclination, some higher power, as it were, or people with money will tap him on the shoulder and say, no, we're not going to have RFK in this position. Another person that came up, I guess, in recent days was Mike Pompeo. He was a neocon. He was involved as a Secretary of State in his last administration, and he's tapped him as somebody he'd like to have on board. Does that contradict the claims that he is an anti-war candidate? Is this truly going to be as bellicose, if not more bellicose, than the Biden-Harris government was?
It remains to be seen whether more or equally bellicose, but I will not accept less bellicose, because exactly as you indicate, the thing that Trump did in his first administration, demonstrably did, and he has a track record of doing, is appointing deep state swamp-dwelling neocon critters to his administration, like Pompeo, like John Bolton, like Avril Haines and people like this. We're all populating the Trump swamp in 2016 to 2020. They will undoubtedly have a seat at the table 2024 to 2028 and continue doing all of the neocon deep state types of things that they were doing in the first administration. There is the possibility that we may see a drawdown in American support in Ukraine, potentially. At least that was something that was talked about during the Trump campaign. But then again, also during Trump's first administration, he not only supported but actually increased sanctions and other economic warfare on Russia. In fact, he was harder on Russia in many ways than the Obama administration had been. So we'll see. We'll see what happens with regards to ratcheting down World War III talk on that front. But there's no doubt that in Israel, with blind support for anything Israel does, including moving the capital to Jerusalem and everything else that is on Netanyahu's wish list, is now back on the table. And, of course, the war against Iran, because one thing that the Trump team has always been on board with is trying to start gin up some sort of war in Iran, which, let's think. Oh, yes, that was definitely a part of the neocon hit list, and it is back on the agenda for a Trump 2024 administration. So, again, I do not accept the idea that this will be a more peaceful administration than what we've seen over the last 4 years.
You mentioned Peter Thiel, who you know, the founder of Palantir and Technologies, the Founders Fund, founder of PayPal, and so on. You know, in addition to supporting Trump, he also, I guess, trained J.D. Vance as basically a protege, right? So I guess, you know, a question I have is, you know, how is that the role of Vance in this new government? I mean, I know you'll say, well, he's just another face, just like Trump. But, I mean, is he using it to as a kind of a, is he like the spare, I guess, if Trump's acting?
Yes. I'll give you a better analogy. He is the George H.W. Bush in the Reagan administration. You will recall back in 1981, when Reagan, of course, was shot by Hinckley and almost assassinated. And from that point on, all reporting shows that Reagan was never the same man again. He was never quite in charge of his administration. And George H.W. Bush was running the Reagan administration from the vice president's office, coordinating Iran-Contra and everything else that came out of the Reagan administration, so-called. I think we may have, potentially, a similar situation with Vance. As you point out, and as I document in a recent editorial series that I have started and will be finishing this coming weekend, The Strange Story of Peter Thiel. I've written the first two parts of that. The third part will be coming shortly, in which I lay out all of Thiel's connections to the deep state, a steering committee member of Bilderberg, Palantir Technologies, all of these horrible deep state connections. But also, as you point out, he is the man who made J.D. Vance who he is. J.D. Vance started his career working for Peter Thiel at Thiel's venture capital fund. He left that to start his own venture capital fund, which was invested in by Peter Thiel. And then even before he announced his Senate run, Peter Thiel had already started and funded a super PAC to support Vance's Senate run to the tune of $10 million. And then when Trump supported Vance's Senate run, Thiel kicked in another $5 million, $15 million that he spent to get J.D. Vance elected to the Senate. And now he was the one personally affected the rapprochement between Vance and Trump. Vance had said some bad things about Trump in the past, but in 2021, Peter Thiel personally got them together at Mar-a-Lago to mend things and patch things over. And then, of course, he gets selected as the VP running mate, who, by the way, it should be noted, Elon Musk made his dark MAGA support of the Trump campaign predicated on J.D. Vance being Trump's running mate. So, yes, clearly they're setting the stage for a deep state operation to be running the scene from behind the scenes. People don't think about the VP. They don't pay attention to it. But just as Dick Cheney was the president under Bush, and just as Bush was the president under Reagan, it's very possible that Vance could be the president under Trump.
Right. Good analogy, too. In the last 2 minutes or so we have left, I want to give listeners an idea of the kinds of solutions that you could offer for Americans, that so they aren't distracted by the two-party trap, a monarchy of money with two faces, essentially. How in general should people direct their energies in a more useful and effective direction for supporting themselves and their communities?
Well, here's the good news and the devastating news for statists of all stripes out there. The news is this doesn't matter. The voting sideshow spectacle is a spectacle that is designed to get you and all of your time, energy, and interest directed at the shadows on the cave wall, and as if you have any control over any of that. You don't, but you do have control over your own life, what you do with your life, the way that you direct your time, your energy, your attention, your resources, who you choose to interact with and in what ways, how you transact with other people in your community, whether you are building community structures that will see you through the coming times, good, bad, or otherwise. Those are the things that matter, exactly as in the dark depths of the scandemic. You saw who were the people who were going to, for example, lock you out of their business because you didn't take an experimental medical intervention or what have you. In exactly the same way, now we are starting to see who can we actually rely on in times of crisis, and how can we foster those communities of interest. And here's a good news story to end things on. Just recently, the EWG group, which has been doing testing on glyphosate levels in oats, oat-based products, cereals, and other things in the United States over the past few years, has found that those levels have been declining because what? Because of the Harris administration or because of some Trump MAGA thing? No, it has nothing to do with the political sideshow. It has to do with growing consumer awareness of and demands that glyphosate be removed from the food supply. Obviously, people who don't know, they should look it up. Glyphosate, known carcinogen, linked to all sorts of medical problems, part of the GMO monstrosity that is being used to shepherd in a new form of food, frankenfood, essentially, into our food supply. People are, to the extent that they have woken up to this and started to put pressure on suppliers and sellers to not use glyphosates in the production, lo and behold, glyphosate levels are declining, measurably, provably declining in oats. We're not there yet, but we're getting there. And that didn't happen through a political process. It happened through people coming together to take action against producers and suppliers. That's the type of action that has meaning in the world, and we can make a difference. It just has nothing to do with ticking a box for your preferred political candidate once every 4 years.
Thank you for your willingness to engage us again on this issue of our day.
You're welcome.
James Corbett is an investigative journalist and hosts and produces The Corbett Report. You can check out his work at corbettreport.com.
That is our show for this week. Next week, we will discuss some of the misdirection on climate change as embodied by this year's United Nations Climate Change Conference, which begins on Monday. Join us again in 7 days. You're listening to the Global Research NewsHour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Ininu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.